Florida's foster care system exists as a safety net for the most vulnerable members of our society, our children. But is that net becoming frayed? This is Florida Matters.
Support for Florida Matters comes from the Hospitals of BayCare Health System, providing more than 100 health seminars, classes, and events each month. BayCare's mission is to build a healthier Tampa Bay. Register for a complimentary health seminar, class, or event at baycareevents.org.
From the Donna Studio at WUSF Public Media, I'm Robin Sessingham. I don't think you'd ever hear foster care administrators or social workers say the system was awash in money. There have always been complaints about overwork and underfunding, but the last few years have really brought some extraordinary pressures to bear on the foster care systems in our area. Our panelists here in the studio to help us understand what's going on with foster care in our community right now. Brina Slater is vice president of the Sarasota YMCA's Safe Children Coalition, which oversees foster care in Manatee, Sarasota, and DeSoto counties. Chris O'Donnell is a Tampa Bay Times reporter who's done extensive coverage on foster care. And Yvonne Maroney is the community outreach coordinator with Hillsborough County's Guardian Ad Litem program. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Brina Slater, how would you describe the problems that are facing the foster care system right now?
Our whole entire Suncoast region are the by far the lowest funded agencies throughout the state right now for the removal rate and the number of children that are in care. Our area specifically in Circuit 12 started about 3 years ago. We started having a heroin, opioid, fentanyl crisis starting about 3 years ago, and it's only increased. We're an area that generally removes 30 to 35 children a month, and towards the end of 2015, October, we removed 109 children were removed.
So you're saying your rate is tripling at some point.
We've tripled.
Of how many children are being removed from their homes?
Yes. We've leveled now at doubled, but we were tripled for a good year. Our removal rates compared to the rest of the state have been 2 to 3 times more a month for the last going on almost 3 years.
All right. So, Chris, I don't think a lot of people understand how the system works. People have heard of DCF, mm-hmm. which is the Department of Children and Families, and they know that's in charge of the foster care system. But having the private social service agencies handling this, how does that all work?
Well, it began under Jeb Bush. When Jeb Bush was governor, they began privatizing the whole child welfare system. And now you have around 20 agencies that are called CBC, community-based care, and they administer child welfare in different circuits around the state. So in Hillsborough County, we have Eckerd Kids. We have the YMCA here for Sarasota and Manatee.
It's a complicated funding mechanism that's happening now, and you're saying this just started under the Bush administration for Florida.
And obviously, I mean, it was a Republican-controlled legislation, and they felt that the private sector and nonprofit sector could do a better job than DCF, which had a bad rap in the early part of this century.
A bad rap because children were falling through the cracks and there were some deaths.
Yep.
And they were trying to improve that record.
Right. And also, I think they're also trying to weigh in costs as well. And if, you know, Republican philosophy is that the private sector can do it better, cheaper.
Mm-hmm. I worked for the Department of Children and Families back in the 90s. So I know I was one of those case managers that was carrying caseloads that are 3 to 4 times the size of our case managers' caseloads now. And you couldn't do good foster care services, protective supervision, adoptive work with the number of kids that we had on caseloads back in the 90s before privatization.
So things have improved in that area.
Greatly. Kids weren't getting medicals and all the things that case managers are responsible for now. They weren't getting.
So it's good to hear that as hard as things are now with all these kids being hit by this opioid crisis, things are a lot better than they were in the 90s. Yvonne, I want to bring you into this conversation. Tell us how the Guardian Ad Litem program fits into this system.
Well, we're a member of the team. When a child is removed, the Guardian Ad Litem program is appointed by the court. And our program is built with volunteers. They visit the children on a monthly basis. They talk to anyone and everyone that has anything to do with the child. And then they come into court and make recommendations to the court for the best interest of the child. So our volunteers come from all walks of life with lots of different experiences. And so they just bring a fresh set of eyes into a system that can get bogged down just with the sheer numbers.
And how many children would one of your volunteers normally be seeing?
They typically work with a family.
So you need a lot of volunteers.
We do. Here in Hillsborough County, we have a little over 700 volunteers. But right now in Hillsborough County, there are more children in care than any other county across the state. We almost have 4,000 children in care right here in Hillsborough County.
Chris, I think I had seen some of your reporting on that Hillsborough was taking in more mm-hmm. than anywhere else in the state?
Yeah.
Why is that?
That's a tough question. 2016, around 1,670 something children were removed in Hillsborough County. That's more than any other county, more than Miami-Dade, which has a population of 1.3 million more people. I spoke to tons of people when I was writing a story on this to try and get an answer, you know, why is it? And certainly, I think these factors play a part. The actual child welfare investigations, the CPI, as they're called, Child Protective Investigators, that's done by the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office. There's around five or six counties where that's, you know, they have the local sheriff's office do it, and typically those counties have among the higher removal rates. So I think they're erring on the side of caution. No one wants to be the investigator that went into a home and said it's okay for a kid to stay here, and then that kid turns up dead 2 weeks later.
So they're more aggressive about removing children.
They're more aggressive. And Hillsborough as well, it's a very big county. It has urban areas where there's high poverty. It also has a lot of rural areas where there's big pockets of high poverty. And maybe I think that if you look at the zip codes where they have removed the most children, you know, I mean, we were talking about how some children, this transcends income and, you know, you get children removed from rich families and poor families. But on the whole, it tends to be poorer families whose children are removed.
And I would imagine areas where the drug crisis is more prevalent.
Yeah,
in
exactly.
A lot of rural areas, you know, you've got.
A lot of the drug problems that we're talking about, you know, the opioids and stuff, it's hitting the poorer communities. And a child welfare investigator who goes into a home and finds evidence of drug use, the child's almost going to be removed 100% of its cases.
Mm-hmm. I think we also have a very transient population. I think Hillsborough County is, you know, like a stopping point as people come into the state from different areas. So I think we have people who are here for a short period of time and then are looking to move somewhere else. But in that period of time, that's when trouble happens because they don't have a support system. You know, if you are moving to a new place and you've got two or three kids under the age of five or six and you don't have a support system, and it just snowballs for some folks.
That's a really good point. Also, if you've got family around, the aunts and uncles can take over for a little while, or the grandparents. They mm-hmm. can go to the grandparents' house for a little while if the parents are having problems. If you've got no support system, like you said, and Florida as a whole is a very transient area.
Absolutely.
Then you tend more to fall into this problem where the kids have nowhere to go except to the state, mm-hmm. to foster care.
I think it's worth talking about the problems that has created in Hillsborough and along the Gulf Coast. Because more children are removed, there's a greater need for foster beds. Last year, I wrote a story about how children had to sleep in offices and a rec center on air mattresses because there just wasn't enough foster beds.
But there were these cottages. I read your article, and it turned out there were these cottages sitting empty. So
yeah,
there was
that
kind
wouldn't
of
have
like,
solved the whole problem, but mm-hmm. that was an example of just poor
mismanagement,
poor communication. Yeah.
Can I add on the children? Because
Brina, go ahead.
Yes, mm-hmm. Thank you. We have the same issues. Foster children cannot be made to go anywhere. A judge cannot order them into a placement. We cannot make them stay in a placement. If a child has a drug issue, we can take them to a drug treatment facility. And if they say they are not signing themselves in, we have to put the child in the car and drive back to the office and try to find another place. We, as you know, Eckerd, have had multiple children with significant DJJ history.
What's DJJ?
Sorry, Department of Juvenile Justice history. Mm-hmm. Where we will call 60 to 70 places throughout the state, and you have to give them the profile of the child, and they won't take the child.
This is surprising. Okay, back up here.
Okay.
So you're saying you have a child who says, I don't want to be placed
Absolutely.
Here, and you can't override the wishes of that child? Absolutely. Even though, what if there's an 8-year-old child who says, I don't like these people. I don't like the way they look.
We generally don't have younger children with these issues. It's generally our, 14, 15, 16, 17-year-olds where they've been arrested several times. And we've had children that had charges throughout the state, multiple.
How do you find families willing to take those children?
Well, that's the problem. What we end up doing is finding a group home, and then that charges $150, $200 a day. And then if the place doesn't feel comfortable with their behaviors, they won't let them mix with other children. We then have to pay a staff person another $20 an hour to watch the child constantly, to have an extra staff person. And that's why there's a lot of budgetary issues with all of the community-based care agencies. We have several children, and we're a lot smaller than Eckerd, that we pay over $400 a day for.
This is very expensive. So talk about the budget. Chris, mm-hmm. I know the legislature gave Eckerd, I think, $3.7 million more for fiscal year 2018. Right. So it's not like they're ignoring the problem.
No, in fact, this year was a good year for the CBC in that regard. Statewide, I believe the budget is around $628 million to the various community care agencies that run child welfare. Eckerd, I think, gets about $74 million a year. And as you said, they just got awarded an extra $3 million, which they plan to use to hire more case managers. And overall, the state actually allocated an extra $70 million for child welfare.
Around the state. Okay. Brina?
I think there's sometimes like a misnomer on the amount of money, because one of the things, and I'll just speak to my circuit for Circuit 12. So for our area, we receive $20 million in core funding. So the state recently sent out some proposals for a formula that's through legislation on the differential. So it's from the current funding and the proposed funding. And all of the community-based care agencies in our area are all, example, I'm $4.5 million underfunded compared to what the state average would be, and I'm receiving 1.7. Eckerd Hillsborough is 9.5 million under, and they're receiving, would you say, 3.7. So, when you think about the amount of money that our region, as the Suncoast region, is grossly underfunded if you compare it to the statewide, because there are CBCs that are, when you look at the formula, significantly overfunded.
How are you figuring underfunded? You mean per child, or in what way are you underfunded?
It's a huge formula that they take into account. Mm-hmm. It's an algorithm for number of abuse reports that come in, number of children that are alleged to be victims, the number of verified abuse reports.
So what you're saying is, for the activity that you're saying you're underfunded.
Yes.
So even though the state has given your circuit more money this year, you're saying it's still not enough to meet the demand, whereas in other parts of the state, according to that legislative formula, they'd have more money than they need.
Well, an example, probably one of the most, would be Miami. So this is the difference between current funding and proposed formula. Miami would be $20 million over.
By this formula that you're looking at.
Yes.
So don't the people who are administrating this money, aren't they seeing these same formulas?
It's in legislative. It's
just politics?
Yes.
I think, I suppose, that the bureaucracy here has been slow to adapt as we've had this opioid crisis that's hit our area more, mm-hmm. and the numbers of children coming into care has shifted. The funding formulas just remain the same.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So this change that's happened just a couple years ago, the ship of the bureaucracy that you're saying is very slow to turn and adapt to that.
And I think that increases the importance of the Guardian Ad Litem program for the kids who are in care, because our program is one of the few programs that basically gives back to the state in the form of volunteer hours and volunteer time.
Oh my gosh, they must be so reliant on those volunteer hours.
Right. It's millions and millions of dollars that statewide that our program actually gives back to the system, because we're there to say, oh no, this needs to be done, or oh no, that was already done, this needs to be done, because we're monitoring the children's cases and what they need. And as case management changes, unfortunately, case managers, they have a tough road.
You're talking about the social workers that work with children.
Directly with the children and with the families. And so let's just say if they have 15 families that they're working with, and each family has two children. Well, now they have 30 children that they're working with. Well, then maybe there's a couple extra parents here or there. So now let's just bump it up to 75 people that they have to keep happy and keep things going and know where they need to be and what services they need. And I doubt very seriously that any of them are only working with 15 families.
It's overwhelming.
So it's just overwhelming.
And the turnover is very high.
Turnover is very high. And
58% or something I read, I think, Chris, from your...
Yeah, the turnover, well, for Hillsborough County, they had 58% turnover in case managers.
And so what happens in that is each child's story gets kind of lost. Ashley Rhodes Corder is a wonderful person who came out of the Hillsborough County foster care system. And she's written several books and she goes on speaking engagements. But when I read an article that she shared, she said that every child deserves one person that knows what color their eyes are. When she went back and read her file, different people reported different colors. And so what a guardian ad litem does for that child is they're the person that knows what color that child's eyes are.
The instability in their lives was just brought home a story that I just read about this troubled teen center that Eckerd was administering. In the story, it was the teenagers were at this teen center until 11 o'clock at night and then sent somewhere to sleep. And then they had to leave that home first thing in the morning and then back to the teen center until 11 o'clock at night. They really had nowhere.
This kind of touches on the issue where we talked about kids can't be forced to go somewhere they don't want to go. And what I heard kind of on the QT was that one of the reasons the kids didn't want to go to some group homes was that their cell phones would be taken away, which was a policy of some group homes. And you can imagine for a teenager who's been disconnected from their normal world, a cell phone is everything. It's a connection to all their friends. So actually, Eckerd has announced they're going to change the policy beginning 2018. They're only going to contract with group homes that allow, you know, children to have access to their cell phones.
But we also have to think, though, too, that although the cell phone is a connection to their world, it's also a connection to the underworld that they could be involved in. So if they're being sex trafficked, if they're, you know, have a substance abuse problem, it's also a connection to those people, too. So I think it has to be monitored. I think kids need that connection, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But I think it also has to be a situation where it's monitored so that it's safe for everyone.
You're listening to Florida Matters. We're talking about the problems facing our foster care system here in the Bay Area. I'm Robin Sessingham. We'll be right back. This is Florida Matters. We're talking about foster care with our guest, Brina Slater, Vice President of the Safe Children Coalition, Chris O'Donnell, reporter for the Tampa Bay Times, and Yvonne Maroney, Community Outreach Coordinator with the Guardian Ad Litem Program in Hillsborough. So we received some emails from listeners complaining about the state being too quick to remove children from their home and there being too much bureaucracy and red tape to go through to get them back. What are the steps that officials have to go through before they can remove a child from the home? Yvonne?
The call is made if there's an abuse allegation. So for Hillsborough County, it would come to the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office Child Protection Team, and they would go out and do an investigation. The last thing I think any of us want is to remove a child from a family. That's very traumatic for the child and the entire family. So the sheriff's office goes out, they do an investigation. If they can't put services in, if the family isn't receptive for services, maybe the family says, no, I don't want you telling me what to do, then maybe the child does need to be removed. And then within 24 hours, it comes before a judge. And in Hillsborough County, there are what we call a shelter hearing 365 days a year.
And the judge makes a determination.
Yes, you made it. Yes, the child should be removed.
So then where do you take the child before you find a foster family?
Well, they're trying to find a foster family
right away. So to take from the home to a foster family.
Or maybe a relative.
I was going to say that's the first thing they look for is a relative. You always want to find a relative first or a non-relative. Sometimes, especially with older children, they might have a best friend whose parents can take care of them, a school teacher that they're connected to. The last resort is foster care.
And by contract, Robin, for Hillsborough County, Eckerd has to take the child off of the sheriff's office hands within 4 hours.
It's the same with my circuit as well.
Mm-hmm. But you have to remember in that situation, if you put yourself in the situation of the parents, they're angry during that whole action. And so sometimes maybe they're not as cooperative as they might be, or maybe they can't get a hold of grandma. Maybe they can't get a hold of an aunt. So we have to kind of, everybody has to put themselves in that situation and understand that, you know, that is a tough situation, not only for the parents, but imagine the children.
Let me ask you all, why do foster families do it?
They always say it's a calling. That's mm-hmm. the number one thing mm-hmm. that whenever you ask a foster parent, mm-hmm. why do you do it? And they say it's a calling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I profiled a foster mom who lives in Riverview, and she had 10 children in her home when I visited her. And a couple of them were her own, but most were foster kids. And she specialized in teenagers, which is the most difficult group to place. And she just has a way with children, and she has a gift, and she just wants to give. And in the you know, a system that has so much negative news, it was really great to see such a positive story.
And she knew what color their eyes were.
Yeah, she did.
And I know you guys recently did the two stories of our two foster moms in Sarasota County, Elizabeth and Kate Dunbaugh, that are absolutely amazing foster parents. Mm-hmm. Their whole goal is to get children back, which is what we ask of foster parents. You know, we ask you to take this child in, to love this child like your own, but to give the child back and be happy about it. And, you know, it's a hurtful thing. And foster parents, you know, they themselves, we've had to refer foster parents for counseling after, because just from the grief and loss of losing a child.
Brina, I'm glad that you brought that couple up. So this special couple, Elizabeth and Kate Dunbaugh, our reporter Stephanie Colombini visited their home and profiled them. Brina, you were there. Let's hear what she had to say.
When you step inside Elizabeth and Kate Dunbaugh's Sarasota home, you find a neat, elegant living room and don't hear much besides the quiet hum of the air conditioner. You wouldn't know six kids under the age of 9 were living there. That is until you walk down the hall, past a bedroom door covered in colorful illustrations and I love you mommy notes, and into the playroom where a couple of toddlers are keeping busy. There's a mini kitchen, a crib for a doll, a sprawling train set, and arguably the largest teddy bear ever made.
This is cute.
That's Brina Slater, vice president of the Safe Children Coalition, which has overseen the foster care system in Manatee, Sarasota, and DeSoto counties for about 20 years. Slater says for most of that time, child welfare agents would bring in 30 to 40 kids a month, and about half would go into foster care. But now,
we've had a 120% increase in the last 3 years.
The coalition knows substance abuse tops the list of reasons cited for child removal this year. Now, substance abuse can mean anything, marijuana, alcohol, but Slater says she's seen a clear connection with the rise in opioid use.
Our area never had more than one or two parents die a year of overdose. We've already had 23 parents die this year.
With all the statistics flying around about overdose rates and child removals, foster parent Elizabeth Dunbaugh says it can be easy for people to lose sight of the real problem.
There's like a little person who just has no idea what's going on, and they're sort of in the middle of it all.
In their 2 years taking care of foster kids, Kate Dunbaugh says several came to them because of opioid abuse at home, and some were more exposed to their parents' addictions than others.
And we noticed in their behaviors that there was definitely evidence of trauma, and we had a 3- and 4-year-old who, for the first several months, anytime we were in the car and they saw a policeman, they would freak out because they'd been trained to look for the popo, and they would alert us and they would duck.
But Dunbaugh stresses those kids' parents turn their lives around and have since maintained a positive relationship with her and Elizabeth. Brina Slater says she wishes the system had more parents like the Dunbaughs, whom she dubs foster moms extraordinaire. But fostering isn't for everybody, and even those interested might struggle to afford it. The average stipend's only about $420 a month per child. Slater says the circuit currently has about 400 kids in foster care and only 179 licensed foster homes.
We've had to actually have a lot of our children that are either placed in group homes to keep the siblings together or outside of our circuit, which means then you have to have a case manager driving to pick them up, or, you know, foster parents having to drive to meet them. And that's not the environment we want for our children.
Which is why sometimes the coalition will waive the state requirement that limits foster homes to 5 children. Kate Dunbaugh says until just recently, they were caring for 7 kids at once.
There's such a need, and you hear the story, and you're like, sure, we'll put in bunk beds, we can make room.
Dumbaugh says seeing kids come out of their shells and make developmental gains during their time in her and Elizabeth's care is what makes fostering so rewarding.
I always get choked up when I talk about this, but I just feel like I'm on the front lines of love every day to see people who are just overcoming incredible odds.
The Dumbaughs say they're the lucky ones for getting the chance to help families heal. For Florida Matters, I'm Stephanie Colombini.
I want to ask you, is there one child or one case that has stuck out in your mind that really kind of keeps you awake at night or makes you do what you do?
I visited a child that I had worked with since she had been born, and she was about 6 years old. And this was about her fourth or fifth foster placement. She had now been separated from her siblings. And I remember sitting on the floor with her the first night at the foster placement and playing a game with her. She basically told me, she said, "You know, if I got underneath your dress, I bet we could leave and no one would miss me."
What'd you say to her?
I said, "Oh, but you've got so much to learn here because this is a special place and it's all about you here. Just wait till you get up in the morning because there's going to be a special treat for you." She was in an amazing foster placement and I knew she just had to trust. So I was able to talk her down and we talked about it. And I said, "And if you wake up in the morning and it's not exactly what you thought it was going to be, call me and we can talk about it." She called me on her way to school and she said it was exactly what I said it would be.
Oh, good. Brina.
I guess because I spent a lot of years on the front part of investigations and removing all the children, now being on the back part and seeing the reunification. And I'm in the same circuit where I was doing investigations at. So I've seen now children who I was part of a removal to see their parents get better, to see their relatives adopt them, to even see foster parents adopt is by far the best gift that anyone could ever see.
Chris.
I met and had a privilege to meet Gene Roy, who's a Tampa resident. He had such a tough childhood. He ended up in juvie. He ended up being sent to Dozier, that infamous school in North Florida. And then after he became 18, he was just in and out of prison. He lost his kids because of substance abuse, two a girl and a boy, twins, really beautiful kids. He worked with Eckerd's reunification team. He had to basically break off ties with the children's mother, who he loved desperately, but she was an even worse addict than he was. And he got his kids back just last year, and I had the opportunity to sit with him, and he told me his life story, and I think I'll always remember that.
Well, thank you. Well, that's it for today's show. I want to thank my guests so much. Brina Slater is vice president of the Safe Children Coalition. Chris O'Donnell is a reporter for the Tampa Bay Times. And Yvonne Maroney is community outreach coordinator with the Guardian Ad Litem program in Hillsborough. Thank you all so much for being here.
Thank you.
Robin.
You can keep the conversation about foster care going on our Facebook page or by emailing floridamatters@wusf.org and visit our website for links to some resources on foster care and more of our coverage on this issue. Florida Matters is produced by Stephanie Colombini. Our engineer is Craig George. Our show is a production of WUSF Public Media. I'm Robin Sussingham. Thanks for listening.